Arrowhead Lutheran camp in order to serve for a summer. And we did, Heather was the crafts lady. And what was really cool about it was the director at the time, his name's Seth Mormon, he's now pastor at Bethany Lutheran in Long Beach. He was the camp director. And we had told him, well, Heather and I can just be camp counselors, right? This kind of, it's our in our wheelhouse. We can easily do this. And he's like, no, I can't make you guys camp counselors. And we're like, well, why is that? He said, well, because a camp counselor, you have to sleep with the youth. Like, so you would be, like, with these other kids, like, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And he says, and I just don't know if I'm ready to take a couple that literally just got married and then end up separating you guys for the next 10 to 12 weeks. And so that's when he said, well, I've got this position where someone can be craft coordinator. Then all they do is they make crafts with the kids all day long, and it's great. And then you don't have to go sleeping with the kids. I'm like, okay, well then, like, what's left? What can I do? And he was like, well, we do have a position, and I'm wondering if maybe you could fill it. I'm like, okay, well, what is it? He goes, can you be a lifeguard? And I'm like, a lifeguard, okay, well, what do I need to do? He says, well, you need to go down to American Red Cross does these lifeguard trainings. Well, the way it all landed was there was not another training to get certified as a lifeguard prior to getting married and then going up to Lake Arrowhead. And so he was still kind enough to let me do it. I'd gotten my lifeguard merit badge in Boy Scouts. Thank you. Thank you. And I was a decent swimmer. And it's just a pool. Do you want to know what makes a lifeguard? Do you think that lifeguarding is about saving little kids' lives? It really isn't. There were three saves, and they were all pretty mild, and it was the other lifeguard that made all those saves. But the lifeguard really is only there for one purpose: to maintain control. And every lifeguard is given that amazing, powerful weapon that will keep all kids in place, the mighty whistle. Oh, man. I wonder what that sounded like in the live stream. Everyone now just, I blew out their TVs. I didn't know that was going to be that loud. It wasn't too bad. Okay. It was really loud in here. I really loved it because the whistle was so good because kids, when you're on the pool, right, all you do is mess around. That's what you're dunking people, you're splashing people. And as a lifeguard, I could be like, hey, and no one's going to turn around. And I could be like glaring, like, when you're messing around, no one's looking at the lifeguard, but then you get the whistle and you blow it. Then all the kids stop and they all look up, which is dumb. If the lifeguard blows the whistle, don't look at the lifeguard. You might actually be the one in trouble. And they would all look at you and you would just be staring at that one kid. You'd be like, you. And the kid would know now. And let me tell you, the power this had. And there was one time I wanted to see how much power the whistle had. So I was talking to an older kid, and I'm like, hey, can you help me out? And this kid, he was a junior counselor, and he was one of the biggest goofballs in the whole camp. He was always breaking the rules. He was always having too much fun with the kids. And so I was like, hey, can you help me out? I need to go use the bathroom really quickly. Can you take the whistle and keep control? And let me tell you, talk about a bubble being blown. He's like, yes, I will. And he put that thing around his neck. And let me tell you, the whistle was blown more times in that 7 minutes than in the entire summer combined. He was like, stop it. No, you're running. And I'm thinking to myself, you're the one that runs all the time. You're messing up. But let me tell you, when you get power, when you get control, it's pretty incredible to forget our place and we lose who's ultimately in control. If I asked you the question, the theological question of who is ultimately in control, all of you will give me the very proper theological answer of God. We all know the answer. The question is, do we live that answer? Who is ultimately in control? As we study Acts chapter 12, I'm going to be focusing on that. I'm excited for this last little bit of Acts 12. I struggled a lot because there's really three directions that this sermon could have gone. And I finally settled on a direction that I think needs to be said, though it's not at first blush what it's supposed to be about. I also felt that I needed to still bring up the other two ideas. And when this has happened in the past, it often means that someone needs to hear something. So I'm hoping that that's the case. So as we go through this sermon and as I bring some of these other sub-themes out, if it's something that hits you, I'm hoping that maybe that's the reason why I didn't zero in completely on this one. So we are talking about Herod and his death. If you remember, you have to go back, Acts chapter 12, verse 1. This is when we're talked, when Herod Agrippa is introduced. And what did Herod Agrippa do right from the get-go? If you remember Acts 12, 1, it starts off with this horrible story of Herod kills James. And again, we talked about celebrity deaths and how sometimes that is a real tragedy in our life. That would have been a tragedy for the early church. They've just started out. They're just starting to grow. And one of the main leaders of the group is now dead. No fanfare, no nothing. This was a shock to the nation, to the Jewish nation. To make matters worse, Peter is captured because Herod Agrippa is like, oh, wow, a bunch of the Jewish people really loved it that I killed James, so maybe now I'll kill someone else and I'll become even more popular. And, of course, the Christians are like, whoa, 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 wait a second, please don't. The Jewish people that are trying to stop this early motion is saying, yes, squash it, stamp it out. And so Herod's like, okay, you know what, I'm going to get another leader, Peter, I'm going to throw him in jail, and then I'm going to kill him. And at this point, the early Christians are probably saying to themselves, who's in charge? Who's in control? Because it looks like evil is in charge, and it looks like evil is in control. That's the reason why this story is included at the end of Acts 12, is because God's going to remind us who is in control. All right, so we keep going. We're going to be, it's technically the second half of verse 19. You got the break there. It's at Herod's death. So from then, Herod went from Judea to Caesarea and stayed there a while. And then Luke adds in some historical context. He had been quarreling with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and they now joined together and sought an audience with him. Having secured the support of Blastus, a trusted personal servant of the king, they asked for peace because they depended on the king's country for their food supply. I'm not going to go into the huge historical context, but Tyre and Sidon was essentially under the thumb of King Herod, and King Herod was like, you know what, I'm going to control this whole thing, I'm going to control this whole narrative, and I'm going to squeeze this off, and I'm going to choke this out. And they were like, hey, let's see if we can get to the king to see if we can secure an audience and maybe negotiate a better deal. So they find out that Blastus was one of the king's advisors. And so they said, hey, we can get to the king via Blastus, and Blastus will help us out on what we should do. And so they get the audience with the king. And on the appointed day, Herod, wearing his royal robes, sat on his throne and delivered a public address to the people. They shouted out, this is the voice of a god, not a man. Okay, so who are you listening to in life? Herod has this incredible upswell of support. And they're saying to him, Herod, when you speak, it's like God is talking. Like, Herod, are you even a man? I don't even think you're a man. I think you must be God in the flesh. Now, when we talk about pride, which is, this is obviously one of the main themes of it, though I don't think it's the main theme, but I think it's important that we at least address this. I like the way one person put it, because I don't know many people here listening who have Herod-level pride, right? Is anyone here, if I started saying you are God in the flesh, would you be like, yes, thank you very much? I don't really know people like that. You know, sometimes you make me uncomfortable when you're like, oh my gosh, that was a great sermon. I'm really sad because Jody Browning always tells me I do terrible sermons. It keeps me humble. Heather's always like, well, no, that wasn't your best. Because sometimes it's very easy when we get filled up with good words, we start thinking a little bit too much of ourselves, right? But I think there's an opposite side of pride that we got to watch out for. Because pride is just not thinking too much of yourself, but it's really thinking of yourself too much. If your life is revolved around you, then it's easy to slip into pride. You start making decisions based upon what you want as opposed to what does someone else want? How can I serve? How can I build up? How can I encourage someone else? And sometimes we fall into this trap. I could preach a very long, lengthy, biblical sermon on pride, but I don't think that that's the main point. The main point here is, who are you listening to? Who are you taking information from? Herod is taking his information, he is taking his self-worth, he's taking all his ideas from only those people who are building him up and telling him what he wants to hear. So what would happen to a man who ultimately just gets told whatever he wants to be told? That's the sub-theme then of pride that comes along. Well, what happens to Herod? He's there on this appointed day. He's out in his royal robes. He's delivering this public address. And they're like, this is the voice of a God, not a man. What is the next thing that takes place? Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down, and he was eaten by worms and died. Amen. Wait, I did not see that one coming. Eaten by worms and died. And it's like, how? Like, this is one of those stories where you read it and you're like, I want to know some of the mechanics of it. And thankfully, we actually have some of the mechanics. We actually have this same event is told by a Jewish historian who turned against the Jewish faith and started writing a history of the Jewish people from the beginning. And his name, and we rely on him for a lot of historical information, his name is Josephus. Josephus records this exact same story, but he helps fill in a little bit of the blanks. To give you just a quick little backstory, Josephus at this point had already reported about Herod Agrippa, that there was a time when Herod Agrippa was out, and he was kind of this quasi-Jewish, quasi-God follower, quasi-religious kind of person. You know, he wasn't into it a lot, but when it suited his purpose, he was really into it. And he was out, and this owl shows up at one of his public speeches. And God tells him that he is now under his favor and that God is going to bless him. But if things get out of control, God would send another owl. And if another owl shows up, it's like, I wouldn't be going to the zoo. I wouldn't be going outside. I don't want to see an owl. If another owl showed up, he would be dead within 5 days. So that's a little bit of the backstory. Now, here is the story as Josephus says it. Now, when Agrippa had reigned 3 years over all Judea, he came to the city Caesarea. It's really interesting. Josephus and Luke are not friends. They don't know each other in that capacity. They're not sharing notes. This is just, we get two different accounts from two different points of view. So it's great that there's all this overlap because it shows that it's an actual real story. And there he exhibited shows in honor of the emperor. On the second day of the festival, Herod put on a garment made wholly of silver. So he's got either silver thread or he's got silver decorations. So what would happen? He would glitter, right? He would have these royal robes on, and it would be this incredible display, like he's showing off. This is fantastic. And of a truly wonderful contexture, and came into the theater early in the morning, at which time the silver of his garment was illuminated by the fresh reflection of the sun's rays upon it. It shone out after a surprising manner and was so resplendent as to spread a horror over those who looked intently upon him. So this is when you remember, you know, when you're driving on the freeway and then you start to turn and the mirror picks up the sun and it zaps you right in the eyeball. Everyone's like, oh my goodness. So again, here's the crowd. They're like, he glitters. He's glowing. This is fantastic. And at that moment, his flatterers cried out that he was a god. And they added, be thou merciful to us, for although we have hitherto reverenced thee only as a man, yet shall we henceforth own thee as superior to mortal nature. Isn't that interesting? Josephus is writing the same thing. Luke condenses it, you are not a man, you are a god. Upon this, the king did neither rebuke them nor reject their impious flattery. By the way, please don't get the idea that God often gives these punishments really. I've always maintained that I would love it to see that if someone really was like a liar, that their pants really would catch on fire. Because then wouldn't it be easy to spot them? They're like, nope, someone's pants are, you just lied to me. Thank you very much. I would love that. This is not one where if someone gives you praise and you don't immediately say, oh, no, 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 not me, not me, not me. That's God, God, God. That's really not what this is. This is Herod, who has lived his life up until now doing this over and over and over and over. So I caution as Christians, sometimes we get a little freaked out by certain things. We're like, well, I got to make sure that, you know, if someone says thank you for this, I've got to somehow quickly give praise to God. Always be giving praise to God. But Herod's sin is that this was a lifetime of him taking all the glory for himself. So upon this, the king neither did rebuke them nor reject their impious flattery. But as he presently afterward looked up, he saw an owl sitting on a certain rope over his head. Now, Josh, can you please make an animated series on this? Because I think this would be a brilliant story. Wouldn't this be great? Like, he's out there like, you're a god, not it. I'm like, oh, thank you, thank you. And all of a sudden you hear this, who? That me, I'm the king. Who? Yeah, me, I'm the. And you look up and it's this owl. Who? Oh, no, I'm in trouble. Yeah. And immediately he understood that this bird was the messenger of ill tidings, as it had once been the messenger of good tidings to him, referring to the previous one. And he fell into the deepest sorrow. At this point, I kind of feel a little bad for Herod, but not too bad. A severe pain also arose in his belly and began in a most violent manner. So he's not feeling too well. Well, because you're wondering, what is this worm's issue? You're starting to put it together. Yeah, like, if you want some good stuff to look at, Google tapeworms in your stomach. Do it. I dare you. Oh. So he's now in a most violent. He therefore looked upon his friends and said, I, whom you call a god, am commanded presently to depart this life. While providence thus reproves the lying words you just now said to me, and I, who was by you called immortal, am immediately to be hurried away by death, but I am bound to accept of what providence allots as it pleases God, for we have by no means lived ill, but in a splendid and happy manner. He's like, lived a good life. You called me immortal, but I'm actually going to be dead soon. After he said this, his pain became violent. Accordingly, he was carried into the palace, and rumor went abroad that he would certainly die in a little time. But the multitude presently sat in sackcloth with their wives and children after the law of their country and besought God for the king's recovery. All places were also full of mourning and lamentation. Now the king rested in a high chamber, and as he saw them below lying prostrate on the ground, he could not himself forbear weeping. So people are out there praying for him, and he's crying like, I think I've made a terrible choice in my life. And while he had been quite worn out from the pain in his belly for 5 days, he departed this life, being in the 54th year of his age and in the 7th year of his reign. So pride is dangerous. But what this is trying to tell us is, who do you listen to? Who is ultimately in control? I know the story of a young girl who was told by an adult in her life over and over and over again, no one likes it when you're silly. Stop being so stupid. Stop being so childish. Stop being so silly. No one likes it. She heard it over and over and over again. Again, maybe, is this a voice that you're listening to? The voice that says, you're not going to amount to anything. Is it the voice of people sending you bad texts? You're fat and you're stupid. Why don't you just go kill yourself? Is this the voice you're listening to? And I think it affects us probably in more ways than we can imagine. I'm grateful that this young girl never, ever listened to that adult saying, no one likes it when you're silly. Because I believe that her joy-filled, childlike demeanor is what carried her through 25 years of DCE ministry. Woo! That's Heather, yeah. Who are you listening to? Again, it's dangerous because sometimes we have other people in our life, maybe even people that we trust, and maybe all of those voices are all saying the same thing. But there's one voice you haven't consulted, the voice of God. I'll be honest with you, this is something I struggle with all the time. Because I know what I'm supposed to do. I know that before I start sermon preparation, what should I do? I should maybe pray, like, God, can you help me not just understand this, but what should I say come Sunday morning? And I don't do it as often as I should. I think in a lot of the big things in life, the real big things, we turn to God in prayer, but it's in those medium things and those smaller things that we listen to everything else. Maybe we listen to our own wisdom, and we might even put something on it like, oh, well, God gave us, common sense, which I don't deny. I'm certain that that's part of our life and our living, but how often do we then go back and say, God, what do you want? If you're getting ready to choose a college, yeah, put out pros, cons, cost, distance from home, parents want closer to home, kid wants way far away from home. And then, of course, the question becomes, have you prayed? Who are you listening to? Are you listening only? Listen to your parents. Listen to your parents. But are you also praying? Are you praying, God, I need some wisdom and I need some help. And I don't want to just listen to everyone else around me and not consult you. You're given an opportunity to go into partnership with a business, with someone else, and it looks really good on paper. It looks like this should work out. It looks like this should be a great thing. And so you say, why wouldn't I do it? It seems like an intelligent decision. It seems like a great opportunity. But then you don't go and you don't ask God. And I'm not saying this in such a way that makes it sound like I'm superior to you. I'm telling you, this is my struggle. Sometimes we need to say, well, what does God say? This is how Searchlight and Friends in Christ merged. When I first got the call from Pastor Larry, he's like, hey, Mark, I think we should merge. Now, I had just gotten out of a really ugly merge. It sounds like it's a relationship, right? I had just gotten out of a really ugly merge, and I'm like, no. He's like, no? I'm like, no, this is terrible. He's like, well, do you want to talk to your board at all? And I'm like, no. And I was, you know what? I'm like, fine. You know what? I'll talk to my board because I already know what the board's going to say. Because the board is going to tell me what I want to hear, and that is, there ain't no way we're going to merge. Because I just think it's stupid. I think there's nothing to it. I pulled my little pros and cons list. You know the biggest con? It was a merge. No. And I'm like, I can't do it. I can't get into another relationship. This is not good. And so I went to the board and I said, hey, talk to Pastor Larry, Friends in Christ, they want to merge. And I say this to my own shame. Do you want to know? I forgot. I think it was Craig Siebel, but I could be wrong. So if there's other board members that remember it differently, please let me know. But I remember someone immediately said, well, we should at least pray about it. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to pray about this. That's terrible. What's wrong with you people? You call yourselves leaders? This is terrible. And I'm like, you know what? Fine. Let's pray and see what, because I knew God was on my side. I knew God knew what he was talking about. And of course, up until then, guess how many times I had prayed about it? Zero. So again, when I say this, I'm not preaching to you, I'm preaching to me. And I remember we started praying, and we had an opportunity to go another direction. I really wanted to go that other direction, I really did. Not because I had prayed about it. I had listened